to order, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 843. Senator Beyer, Senator Atkinson, and Mr. Hemingway, you're going to tell us why we're here.
Sometimes I wonder about that, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, State Senator from Lane County. Why we're here, what we would are bringing before you today is the first piece of actually a three-part energy package that we're working with to try to make sure that Oregon doesn't have the problems that our neighbor to the south has experienced this last year, both in the short term and in the long term. The first piece that you're going to see, Senate Bill 843, is what we've called the emergency energy piece, and it's intended to help us be in a position where we can assure that there's some supply in place next fall in case the water doesn't come up to what we hope it will behind the dams. Pieces that will be seen later that really are going to come across in the House side is a long-term siting piece that intends to encourage and make it easier for utilities and generators to put capacity supply in place quickly to meet more of the midterm issues that we've talked about. And then there's some inducement pieces that are in it also that have to do with Senate Bill 520 and 521, which have already come out of the Revenue Committee, which removed the sunset on the energy conservation bills that are in there, and some other issues, including the promotion of fuel cells is one of the things that you'll hear about. Today, what we'd like to do is just kind of introduce Senate Bill 843, and we've got Roy Hemingway from the governor's office and my colleague, Senator Atkinson, and I, who have been working with this. I will tell you that the process that we've used to put these together is we've tried to get all of the interest groups, from consumers to utilities to generators to I'm not sure who, a pipeline company is otherwise concerned. And the question we really asked them is, what do we need to do in terms of changing Oregon legislation to encourage and make it easier for producers to bring more energy online, keeping in mind that we need to live within the clean air and clean water standards? And second behind that, what can we do to encourage the other side, the sort of the demand side, to do conservation? So that's what we've intended to do, and I believe you will see a group of people come to this table today that said, regarding this piece, this is a good thing to do, and I don't believe you'll hear much criticism. At least I hope so. That's because in the good spirit of legislative work groups, we've had them all here and got agreement on everything. That's in my way of introduction. I'll let Senator Atkinson answer.
They're all
that.
Behind you.
They're all behind me, and they better be all shaking their heads up and not.
He's like a duck in the back of my neck. Senator Atkinson.
For the record, my name's Jason Atkinson, State Senator of District 25, also known as the dog in the Dog and Pony Show. I would just add just a couple of things as we're about to walk through the bill. This has been a bipartisan issue or bipartisan project. It's also been a project that has had input from the House. I think the thing that's interesting to note is that we are very interested in moving a handful of bills, a bundle of bills, through in the next few weeks, this obviously being the first of three that are the most important. This particular bill, I think before you, you'll see a very thick dash three we're about to walk through. The dash three, and also as you'll hear from people who testify from or behind us briefly, has had some really, as you'll see, really well-drafted, negotiated pieces of language that essentially say, answer that question of what incentives do we have to get power on the Northwest and the Oregon power grid as fast as possible. And so that is the intent that Senator Beyer and I have worked on, and that's really where we are, and we're proud that that we have met all the deadlines and we are here on time.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I'm proud to be here among such distinguished company. The irony of living in the Pacific Northwest is that when you're experiencing wonderful days like today outside, there is a regret that you must also have, and that is that we are experiencing about half of the normal precipitation that we have in an average year throughout the Pacific Northwest. This is not unusual. This weather pattern here is true in Washington, Idaho, Montana, British Columbia, and Alberta throughout the Columbia Basin. And the result is what we're referring to as kind of the perfect storm of bad energy events. We have an energy situation in California which has driven up prices in the wholesale market for electricity to at least 10 times their normal level, sometimes as much as 100 times their normal level, at a time when the Pacific Northwest is relatively short of power because we have not built power plants to keep up with our rising demand. And then we get a winter like this one, which is going to produce probably about 4,000 average megawatts of power less in hydropower in the Columbia River and similar amounts less in the other basins in which hydroelectric energy is generated. And so given this situation of very low stream flows, high energy prices, and shortages of generation, it is appropriate that we focus on a number of things that state government can do to set this right. Senate Bill 843, as Senator Beyer and Senator Atkinson have indicated, is one piece of a number of things that we're doing. The next two pieces will be one that deals with long-term energy siting issues, and the third piece will be one which deals with energy conservation. I'm not going to go through the bill in any detail. The objective here was to look at things that we could do quickly to get generation on the ground to deal with the immediate situation this year and next. And there are people behind me who have worked in detail on the bill who can provide the section-by-section analysis.
Okay, thank you, Roy. Questions? The dash 3 is the bill. But I got that right.
That's correct. Yeah. Mr. Chair, this is the proverbial gotten stuff.
I mean, there's nothing in the bill other than these first 3,000 pages.
That's the one. It's just a few simple changes.
Just wanted to make sure. Okay, thank you, Roy. Gentlemen, you two get back up here. We got work to do.
All righty.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Who's the actual author of these amendments? I mean, who's the certified smart person to ask questions to?
We're going to get a section by section.
Oh, we are. Okay.
Yeah, that's coming up right now.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, do you want us to ask questions section by section?
That'd be the best thing, probably.
Yeah. Certified smarts are would be out there.
Yeah, that scares me.
The best shot you got.
Good afternoon. I'm Mark Hellman with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I can talk about the changes on pages 2, 3, and 4, the amendments, which allow for. What these amendments do is they amend the Public Utility Commission's general power statutes such that the commission can delegate its authority to an arbitrator in deciding how much a generating resource is worth when parties disagree about a commission order on valuation. And this is very important because it'll help ensure that resources are reasonably valued through an administrative process, thereby avoiding the need to sell a resource to settle a dispute on how much a resource is worth. And identifying how much a resource is worth is a critical part for providing value to consumers that are eligible for direct access, because commercial and industrial consumers who are eligible for direct access are credited with their share of the value of the plant, regardless of who they buy power supply from. And that's a critical need in order to have the market competitive. And so that that critical element is to ensure that other energy suppliers to direct access consumers, when they're selling the power, that those consumers don't have to choose or lose the value of the resources that the utility has and that's been in rates historically. This legislation also allows for an agreement among a very broad set of parties on these valuation rules to move forward regarding the commission process as to how the utilities generating resources ought to be valued. I'm available if you have any questions on those pages.
I have some questions. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, you're here to interpret the new language on pages 2 and 3, is that?
I'm here to do my best.
Okay. Let me see. What does it mean on lines 4 and 5? Any person selected to arbitrate the valuation dispute shall be experienced in valuing generating resources. What does that mean? What is the experience required to be experienced and qualified?
What that means is that the person who is going to arbitrate what the value of the resource is among dispute among a number of appraisers, that person has to be experienced in valuing resources. It has to be someone who has been in a practice of going across the country and appraising resources and be able to say how much they are worth.
Where does the bill say that that's what experienced means?
You don't have to file that.
Well, I, Chair, I guess in that remark, that may be in the reading. To me,
I'm saying this because when you go down to line 9 and 10, it says that the challenge is limited to the allegations of bias or lack of qualification. And yet the qualification is not clearly defined. It says there to be experience, but then there's no definition for experience. So at least for the record, I'd like to know what in the world you're talking about.
Well, I think in that you have a number of appraisers. There's going to be an appraiser representing commercial and industrial consumers. There'll be an appraiser representing small consumers. There might be appraisers representing the utility. And so there'll all be different parties to this arbitration proceeding. Now, even though the commission is selecting or in a position of selecting the arbitrator, it could be that one of these other parties doesn't like the selection. And what the legislation is saying is, okay, if you don't like the selection of the arbitrator, well, you have only two reasons for being able to challenge that. One's bias and the other one's lack of qualifications.
Okay. I mean, I understand what it's supposed to be doing, but I don't understand how that's to be determined. How do you determine what the qualifications are? It says they're supposed to be experienced. It doesn't define experience, but then it says supposed to be qualified, and I assume that incorporates experience, but yet it's not defined. So I mean, if there is a challenge, who has standing? Anybody who says, I don't think this person is qualified, qualified based on what? I don't think this person has enough experience based on what? I'm trying to set a record here just for the purpose of any court challenges.
Chair, yes. I think it would be the commission's ruling that would be challenged, and I think a court would look at what the commission said, and I think in the commission's choice that they would be putting out different descriptions and all as to why they thought that the...
So the answer to the question is in the opinion of the commission. So is that what you're saying to me? It's solely in the hands of the commission to determine what experience level is appropriate?
Yes.
Other questions? Section 1.
Other questions.
Okay.
Okay. So, and council's pointing out to me, council staff is pointing out to me that they're going to adopt this by rule. Is that correct?
The commission has rules before it that will be able to go forward with this legislation being passed. Mm-hmm. Now, what the rules anticipate at this point is that the appraisers of each of the different parties get together and they choose an arbitrator. And that choice, I believe, would be approved by the commission. And so when they go and challenge the choice of the arbitrator, I think the first venue is before the commission.
But doesn't this eventually, couldn't this conceivably end up in the Court of Appeals? I guess what I'm trying to get to here is setting a record so in the Court of Appeals, if they were to get one of these challenges, would have something to look back at to say what experience level are we talking about, what direction is really being given to the commission for the purpose of drafting the rules.
Chair, I agree with you. I think the commission deals with these kinds of issues all the time when it has witnesses before and whether those witnesses qualify as experts in the field. That's something that they review and consider.
Okay. I think maybe one thing you may have hit on, you're really looking for somebody with experience who is an expert in the field of appraising something?
Yes.
No, maybe?
Yes. The arbitrator is an expert in appraising, valuing resources.
Okay. So we're really looking for somebody with very specialized knowledge, very specialized experience in the area of appraising these types of resources.
Chair, yes.
So our expectation is that the commission will adopt rules consistent with that.
Chair, yes. The commission could expand on rules that it has to make sure that the definition of experience and valuing resources is sufficient to provide a basis for defending the decision.
Okay. A couple of other questions then. If I can move on, I mean, I'm not sure if we've set a really good record here or not, but I'm basically trusting that the commission is going to adopt rules to require that the person is, in fact, an expert in the area of appraising these kind of resources, and that that's going to be the basis on which the commission will ultimately judge any challenge to the appointment of an arbiter in these kind of cases.
Chair, I think that the parties themselves and the appraisers that they have a very, very strong incentive to make sure that the arbitrator that they pick is well qualified, because the decision that arbitrator is going to make will affect many millions of dollars on each of the parties. And so they have a vested interest to make sure that the arbitrator that they pick is well qualified.
Okay.
Do all these decisions go to arbitration, or is this just a very infrequent occurrence to date? Is this a big deal or not?
This is a big deal. To my knowledge, the Public Utility Commission has not used arbitration for resolving its own orders. The commission does do arbitration and involved in arbitration with respect to telecommunication interconnection agreements. But what this is specific enabling legislation to allow a commission order on a value to go to arbitration and have that arbitration settle on what the value of that generating resource is. So this would be unique, and it's for this stated purpose.
I guess Senator Menace's focus of trying to ensure that we have a clear line of what an arbitrator is, how they're selected so they can't be challenged. So this is important. Line.
Yes, it is. It is important, and it's for this specific instance of generating resources, and parties will be very well incented to make sure that, that this process proceeds appropriately and that an arbitrator is an expert in order to participate.
Okay. Senator Minnis, you have some follow-ups?
Yeah. Line 9 says that, it says any party may challenge the selection of an arbiter by direct petition to the commission, but the commission's review of the selection shall be limited to allegations of bias. Allegations of bias mean what?
Allegation of bias in this case might mean that they have some kind of vested interest in the plant. They might have some kind of financial interest with one of the utilities or clients.
Is that also what we call a material conflict of interest?
Yes.
Okay. So, and I'm trying to tie these things back together because that's one of the other qualifications. They cannot have a material conflict of interest. So if
yes.
It did, that would be bias. It's not just having a different opinion that I don't agree with.
Chair, yes.
Okay, I went to the wrong college or whatever. Okay. Mr. Chairman, again, get down to lines 24. It says the decision was procured by corruption, fraud, undue means. Corruption, fraud, I mean, are we tying these back to any kind of statutes, any kind of intent, any kind of, what kind of corruption are we talking about?
Chair, bribery. I mean, the point on this is that there are only specific limited kinds of cases in which the decision would not be adopted by the arbitrator. And so you'd have to show that...
Are we talking about corruption that rises to the level of criminal conduct, or are we talking about corruption that rises to the level of civil complaint?
Chair, I'm not an attorney, but corruption means that there was definitely an undisclosed bias there, is how I would look at it.
All right.
Other questions? Are we happy with Section 1?
Mr. Chairman, I think it could be tight. The language could be tightened up more, but I'm satisfied with the answers that we're being given. Just kind of a follow-up question. Is this language used anywhere else in other similar statutes? I mean, is there some guidance that can be given to... Anybody out there know? Legislative counsel, anybody certified smart in this area?
And unfortunately, my attorney isn't present, but my guess is that he did look at other kinds of statutes, because the Attorney General's office has been looking at the delegation issue in general and wanted to make sure that this language here is sufficient and satisfactory to the Attorney General's office that it could go forward.
Okay, again, and what I'm looking for is whether there's any case law out there or anything that gives guidance to the interpretation of these terms and application in your practice.
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. The language that you see in subsection 8, at least the first four items that you see there, are taken from the statutes in Chapter 36, which deal with commercial arbitration. In fact, I think they were probably copied straight out of there by the Attorney General. So these are the standards that are used in commercial arbitration when you want to challenge the decision of an arbitrator because there are fairly limited grounds for challenging an arbitration decision in commercial arbitration, and this was intended to limit those categories.
Mr. Hendricks, does this happen very often? Many challenges?
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, I don't believe it probably does. I'm sure that back when I was in private practice and I did a couple of commercial arbitrations, certainly I was looking at them very hard when I came out on the bad end of it to see if there was some way to make an argument that, in fact, there was a means to appeal. But I think these are pretty tight language for preventing any appeals of decisions of an arbitrator in these circumstances.
All right. Thank you. I'm happy.
You have to go.
One down.
Section two.
Okay. Once we get into section two, we're talking about the ORS 469-300. For the record, my name is Dave Stewart Smith. I'm the administrator of the Energy Resource Division for the Oregon Office of Energy, and I've been working with this group brought together by Senator Beyer and Atkinson to come to some agreement on this language. This bill makes several changes to existing energy facility siting statutes. I'll go ahead and walk through them. In Section 2, the change involves changing the jurisdiction of the state's Energy Facility Siting Council for renewable energy resources. And the jurisdictional level will change from 25 peak megawatts to 35 average megawatts. And determining average megawatts will be done by the calculation inferred in Section 5. You can see at the top of page 5, line 5. So that is the first change in Section 2. The second change in Section 2 takes, because we're defining jurisdictional level in a different way, it removes renewables from the existing from the existing place for the definition of energy facilities and creates a new subsection J on page 7, line 19, to implement that definition for council jurisdiction for renewable energy facilities. Let's see that, and then the rest of the changes in section 2 are renumbering. Section 3, if there are no questions.
Okay, stand by a second.
Okay.
Section 2, going once. Gone.
Yep, can I speak told for Senator Minnis?
No, you may not. Section 3.
Section 3.
All right, you had a race before his wife gets him back to us.
The, the changes in Section 3 start on page 13, line 6, and continue through the top of page 14, and then again on pages 15 and 16. This is the creation of an outright exemption from siting council jurisdiction for temporary energy facilities. What we've tried to craft here is an answer to this short-term energy capacity problem. And there may be several areas throughout the state, existing industrial sites, could be existing power plant sites, sites that already have access to electric transmission capacity, natural gas. They'll not need a great deal of expensive infrastructure in order to get online quickly. And we then have created this exemption for this temporary power plant from siting council jurisdiction as long as it meets a set of criteria, such as they've got local land use approval and the plant must operate for only 24 months, so there's several different provisions for implementing that. But the sense of it is to allow the development of some temporary power plants over the next couple of years to answer what we feel right now is a short-term capacity problem, while the larger, longer-term plants are being developed. We have a number of those in review right now, and a number of developers interested in building large. Larger long-term power plants, this is the stopgap measure.
Okay. Section 3.
Well, that was Section 3.
Going once. Section 4.
I believe Section 4... are conforming amendments in order to be able to implement the temporary nature of this. These power plants can only be built within a certain period of time, and so therefore the language will not be permanent in the ORS, and I believe that Section 4 is the section that implements the eventual removal of that language from the statute. So there's no substantive changes there. As Section 5 says, the amendments implemented by Section 4 become operative January 2nd, 2006, and that's the time that that language will be, again, removed from the revised statutes.
Okay.
Section 6. Any questions on 4 and 5 then?
Nope.
Okay. Section 6, the only change is on page 25 at line 12. It changes the level at which a power plant can qualify for expedited review from the Energy Facility Siting Council to the average capacity measurement. So this would allow larger power plants to go through the expedited review process. Okay.
Don't take a breath.
Section 7 is another change. The change is actually on page 28, line starting at line 4. An additional provision that we have provided for that will give a little bit of an easier time through the siting process for renewable energy resources. We've carved out a number of standards. Standards such as our soil stability standard and our recreation standard, that the power plant will not have to prove compliance with those standards. It will result in a shorter application. It'll result in less time to find the application complete, but the council retains the ability, should there be an issue that needs to be addressed in the site certificate, the council retains the ability to condition the site certificate to comply with the form, the sense of the standard itself. Essentially, what this does, what this provision does, is it provides a presumption that the standard has been met and gives the council the authority to condition the site certificate to ensure that. So this, again, is a way of giving renewable energy resources a little easier time through the process.
You ready for Section 8?
Roger, this one.
Right.
Section 8 has one of your provisions in it.
Section 8 has two changes to definitions. The changes are on page 29 and page 32, definitions number 10 and 36. And what these changes will do is they will allow the utility to provide a safe harbor rate to commercial and industrial consumers, because without these changes, the utilities, the electric companies, would have a risk that when they go out and prudently buy for these customers to serve them on the standard offer, that they may change their mind and go somewhere else, and the utilities would be left with these expensive contracts and no one to recover them from. And so with these changes, the utilities would be assured of their cost recovery, and they'll go out and prudently purchase power for customers so that they have power to buy, and the power will be at a more reasonable and stable rate, because they'll be able to contract out for a couple of years where power prices are more reasonable than merely relying on the short-term market.
Chair Harper, members of the committee, my name is Lee Sparling. I'm administrator of the Electric and Natural Gas Division at the PUC. And if we're ready to move on to Section 9, that's something I will address.
Okay, Lee.
Thank you. The purpose of Section 9 is to make some minor changes in the provisions relating to the 3% public purposes charge that will go into effect for electric companies on October 1 this year. That applies specifically to Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp. If I can direct your attention to page 36, there's a provision beginning at line 9 that basically says that when the utilities begin collecting this 3% public purposes charge, they are no longer responsible for running their own programs that are in statute with respect to, first, the residential weatherization programs. That was already in the provision. This amendment also adds the commercial energy services programs, which are also specified by statute. So basically, I view this as pretty much a housekeeping type of amendment, or to correct an oversight when the statute was originally drafted last session. Again, what it does is it removes the obligation from the utilities to run their own programs once they're collecting this 3% public purposes charge. As you may know, the public purposes charge will be simply collected by the utilities and dispersed to other agencies, in part to the Housing and Community Services Department, and a large chunk of it will be directed by the Public Utility Commission for use in conservation and renewable resource programs. So in a sense, the responsibility is removed from the utilities, and this language clarifies that the statutory provisions that had previously specified residential and commercial programs would no longer apply to those companies.
Okay. Page 34.
Yes, sir. There is one other change here. I can't speak very directly to it. Legislative Council made this change. Mr. McCarthy was here a moment ago and may have been able to explain it, but he informed us that the expert in Legislative Council with respect to education issues indicated that this clarification of how certain funds were to be divided up among the school districts was a necessary change.
I think it's just if there's a component in the ASD, if that's in fact the case, I think that's what it says. Senator Durfin?
Yeah, I'm not on the committee, but could I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let me go back.
Yes,
to
boss, you can do anything.
Transition costs on these temporary units. If you, I give an example, if someone, how fast are they going to amortize these temporary units? Would they amortize them over the 24-month period, or would they amortize them over a longer period of time?
We're going back to the temporary generating plant exemption.
Okay.
These power plants, the way we've set this up, these power plants can only operate for 24 months. Now, they may pay that back over a longer period of time, but essentially, if it's going to make economic sense for the utilities or the independent power producers that do this, they're going to have to see that it makes economic sense within that 24-month period, I would think.
So you think they would amortize it over the 24-month period, the cost?
The way it's written, that is the way it looks to me.
The question I would have is, say that a utility put in a temporary unit, after a year they find they could go on the open market and buy it less costly. They go out and buy it less costly, but they still have an unamortized expense. And if the individual wanted to go out in the market, he'd still be responsible for that unamortized cost.
Chair, Senator Durfler, my hope is that for these temporary units that the commission and the utilities work together to essentially get a win-win result on an expected basis, and that for being able to have a share of this temporary power that would be produced, which would allow the company to avoid very, very high price power, that the commission would agree that some or all of the costs of those facilities would get recovered. That, to me, is up to the utility in some sense as to whether they want to take advantage of that opportunity or whether they want to try and have that as a purely market resource. But from my thinking, because of where those facilities are located and they're should be adjacent or next to resources that are already in rates, that it makes sense to work out a cooperative agreement so that it benefits both consumers and the electric company.
Okay, but you could still, if you amortize them out over, say, a five-year period, there'd still be a fairly large transition cost if somebody wanted to go out in the market system, which would discourage them from doing that, I would think.
Chair, Senator Durfler. My impression is that these are pretty, in the realm of things, pretty low-cost kinds of units where it's essentially a jet engine that you're bringing in to a plant so that you can produce electricity. And from these units, if the alternative is buying power at a dollar a kilowatt hour, which sometimes market prices are at, that it would be much more economic to take advantage of these resources to avoid having to go out to market and make those kinds of purchases.
I understand it has to be a balanced system so everybody comes out, but I could also see how they could play games with it and eliminate the transition when somebody's going to go out on the market.
Chair, Senator Durfler, these are temporarily sited units that would have 2 years, I think, of permitting. So something has to happen after 2 years. This is just a temporary fix so that we can avoid getting hurt as the markets settle down and new permanent supply is being built to serve the Western United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Durfler, one of the things we've also noticed with units like the units that are likely to be put in under this temporary exemption is that they also are the kinds of units that are used in industrial plants for cogeneration capacity. And so there's a big call for those right now. We're seeing a great deal of interest in cogeneration, and my sense is that those units will have an aftermarket value as well after the couple of years that they would operate.
Okay. Hope you're right.
And give them back to the base when they're finished using them, maybe.
Yeah.
Ten.
It's a hole.
Ten. Where is it?
On page 40.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just looking for the first change. The changes in Section 10 are, as we had it described to us yesterday from Legislative Council, conforming amendments because we had to do some renumbering earlier in the statutes under the definition section. We had to add a definition, so they had to renumber them.
Okay.
And that, I believe, is the only change in 10. In Section 11, page 51, line 25, another the same conforming amendment. Number 12, let's see, oh, number, Section 12 was a Legislative Council change to clarify an existing statute, and essentially what the Legislative Council tries to do, because adding definitions to the statute often causes a lot of renumbering, they're trying to take the actual the numerical citation for the definition out and put in the defined term, so that they don't have to amend that if those get renumbered again in the future. So this is just an amendment to make things a little bit easier and a little less confusing during future legislative sessions. Section 13 is a provision, again, for renewable energy resources to suspend the council's use of an energy generation area for the balance of the year 2001. An energy generation area is an area that the council defines by rule, and we have defined one, a wind energy generation area in northern Umatilla County. And essentially what it recognizes is within a certain geographical boundary, a number of small generating plants could have the cumulative effect of a single large generating plant of those small plants added up. And it allows the council to work require a site certificate for those smaller plants that may individually be under the council's jurisdictional level if they're within that generation area. And what we've agreed to here is a suspension of that for the balance of this year while we are looking at getting generating resources on the ground, and we will work closely with the counties that will then be responsible for siting some of these smaller plants within the wind energy generation area. I have talked to Umatilla County about this, and we've assured them that we stand ready to help them in this short term in order to get those facilities reviewed under the county land use process. And the last two sections of the bill are the section 14 repeals the language in section 13. It's what implements the energy generation area waiver only for the balance of 2001, and then section 15 is the emergency clause for the bill.
Very good. Thank you. Overall comments, questions, specifics. We heard Senator Domenech on the concerns about the arbitrator definitions, making sure that withstands scrutiny. Everything else pretty much as is.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Tom Gallagher.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing PG&E National Energy Group. With me is Dave Robertson, public affairs director for the same. We're here to support the bill.
Senator, how are you, Mr. Chair?
Great, buddy.
How's the wife and kids?
Okay. Mr. Chair, we're here to support the bill. The short-term bill, I think, deals with a lot of the power crisis issues that we have in front of us right now, and we support all the pieces in it, specifically the renewable energy piece, the 35 megawatts, et cetera. We're really focused on the long-term bill, which is the piece that you don't have, that's going to be starting on the House side, and I do want to make my comments on that one, but directly related to this bill. We as market generation, were asked two questions when we went into this work group. The first one is, how can we get new generation in the ground quickly and get kilowatt hours up and running for the shortage that we have right now? And the second one is, who's going to build that new generation? And those are questions that we're very concerned about. In the long-term bill, I think the answers to how fast can you get in the ground and how fast can you build generation, I think that's where those answers are. And the second one is, who's going to build it, is very much something we'd like to do. I think there's more and more developer activity right now. There are, when we started this, we were about the only one active, and there are at least four developers now who are involved in this work process. And there are a great number of plants in the process to get sited. And I think under the long-term bill, we can move that forward. So we look forward to working with you on both of these bills. We'd be happy to answer any questions on this bill or the bigger questions.
Look at the ad, Mr. Chair.
Good. Thank you. Rachel Shimshack?
Very good.
Hey.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Rachel Shimshack. I'm the director of the Renewable Northwest Project. We're a regional advocacy organization, and we promote solar, wind, and geothermal resources throughout the four states in the Northwest. And I'm here also to comment on Senate Bill 843, which is intended to provide some solutions to our current energy crisis. And our view is that the core of this crisis is a fundamental demand and supply problem. Our view is that aggressive conservation and a diversity of new resources, starting with renewables, is a good solution to the problem. We are blessed in this region to have a lot of renewable resources available but not yet developed. Just wind alone has about 133,000 megawatts of potential. Most of that is in Montana, but some of the best sites are in Oregon and Washington. The good news is that over 400 megawatts are being developed even as we speak and will hopefully be in the ground and operating by the end of this year, contributing a clean energy solution to the problem that we have. As you know, renewables provide good environmental benefits, but they also provide economic development benefits. Again, specifically for wind resources, they are often found on farmland and ranch land, and that land, those landowners receive royalties for the turbines that that are placed on their land. That provides a second source of income for those landowners, kind of a second crop, I guess I would say, and allows them to stay in the farming business. So it allows good economic developments for the state. Senate Bill 843 helps stimulate the development of new renewables by speeding up the approval process for these things. It allows slightly larger process projects to go directly to the local review process, and hopefully some of those will be online and be able to help service this coming winter. It also tailors the FSEC process for larger renewable projects to renewable resources. In the past, some of the standards that FSEC uses are more relevant to large fossil fuel plants and not really to renewables, and so this tailors the process some. I think with this bill, we'll be able to diversify our energy resources and make the system more stable and cleaner for the future. Thank you very much. Good. Happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you. We're happy.
Thank you so much.
Cindy?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Finlayson, and I represent Portland General Electric. PGE supports Senate Bill 843. As amended, PGE has worked in cooperation with a coalition of customers, state agencies, consumer-owned utilities, and public utilities to address and craft the energy crisis citing legislation. As a utility that must look to the market to meet a portion of our supply needs for our customers, we've seen firsthand what a supply shortage can mean in terms of price volatility. Only a combination of increased supply and conservation will actually stabilize pricing. PGE recognizes the need for both short-term and long-term siting legislation to meet regional power needs. And this is the first of at least a two-piece series of legislation. This is a short-term siting, which includes energy conservation, renewable energy resources, temporary energy generation facilities to meet energy demand, loads, and customer protections. We are working with the same coalition on the long-term siting legislation, and we look forward to continuing to work with them to help meet the needs of the region. Any other questions? It's a me too for PGE.
Me too. Thank you. Kevin?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Kevin Lynch, Managing Director of Government Affairs at PacifiCorp. Thanks for the opportunity to come. In the interest of brevity, I will not go over how we got where we got right now with respect to the region's energy picture, and instead I will state my company's virtually unequivocal support for every piece of this bill and just take 1 second to describe the only place where we have any bit of equivocation. There are five objectives that I think we're all trying to reach right now to deal with the situation in front of us. Stimulate construction of new generation in the near term to increase supply, encourage reductions in demand through load curtailment and efficiency, address issues that have arisen in the last 2 years since Senate Bill 1149 was enacted and the subsequent implementing rules were adopted, provide the functional equivalent of a regulated cost of service rate for customers who otherwise would be going to market on October 1st, and facilitate the siting and development of new long-term generation resources that would ultimately prove beneficial to the state. The legislation in front of you, I think, addresses objectives 1, 3, and 4 quite well, and we wholeheartedly support, in particular, the language that gives the commission the authority to delegate the resource valuation decisions to an arbitrator. We also support the provisions that expedite the siting of temporary facilities and that relax a bit, at least for a while, the requirements for siting new renewable facilities. And with respect to all three of those, I guess I would say that we have a vested interest in seeing all of those things go forward in an expeditious manner. As I mentioned, perhaps only one place of a bit of equivocation is on the issue of changing the definitions of economic and uneconomic utility assets in Senate Bill 1149. And let me describe, I think, where everybody working on this issue is as participants in a work in progress. The standard offer safe harbor provision that is being contemplated now was nothing that was envisioned 2 years ago when Senate Bill 1149 was enacted. In fact, it wasn't envisioned a year ago when the rules were being worked on. We're being asked to do a little bit of catch-up to try to bring the statute and, more importantly, the rules up to date to address a difficult market situation. So that inevitably takes a little bit of new thinking and a little bit of effort. And we've recently, my company has proposed a set of rule changes that would, in our opinion, get to the point where that kind of that standard offer product works both for our customers and for our company. And I'm happy to report that we've had an initial meeting with a number of other stakeholders and commission staff yet this afternoon. And I thought that I attended the meeting. The discussion was very positive. I'd say with respect to the work in progress that's ongoing, a lot of progress is in fact being made. I'm hopeful that that we can get this worked out on a timely basis so that both my company and our customers know what we're facing in the next couple of months, that we can provide this product to our customers in lieu of having them go to market and in a manner where everybody feels comfortable with the way it's going to work. So with that very, very minor, I'd even hesitate to call it a caveat, I'd urge the committee to move favorably on this legislation. Thank you.
When you say rule, PUC administrative rule?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Not anything that we need to be.
I think there, Senate Bill 1149 was written with the expectation that the commission would fill in a lot of the spaces with implementing rules. I think the more clarity that we have, either in law or in rule or both, for what the obligations of a utility going forward are to provide either to buy power or to build new plants to do this standard offer product is important, and that's really the nub of the issue that we're trying to work out right now.
Could you point in this LC draft? Can you point me to where those definitional changes are,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menas, Section 8. It's kind of hard to describe. If you look on page 29, line 10, there is, 10 and 11 rather, there's a section that's bracketed. And similarly on page 32, lines 19 and 20, the intended effect of the bracketing is, the intention of the definitions is to create a threshold date by which assets of the utility are considered in a pool for valuation and determination of either transition credits or costs. In doing the standard offer, the point was, in setting up the standard offer, whereby the companies, the utilities, are purchasing power or providing power for customers that choose not to buy directly in the market. The point was made that if you set a threshold date for the offering of direct access, then there is a vulnerability to the utilities that purchases or made after that date in order to meet the standard offer obligation could not be considered in that calculation of transition credits or transition costs. The concern that we have is that the language is sufficiently broad that when you take the date away, it may also bring in a new set of generation resources that we may begin to engage in building after that date, or that we have intended to do after that date. And the real problem is that it is the policy of the state at this point that the utilities are basically getting out of the business of building new regulated generation. And if you slip this date out in this definition, it sort of muddies that policy. And we think that from a business standpoint, you know, we've been proceeding and developing our own business plans both for the Oregon market and for the other five states in which we, well, four of the five states in which we still have regulated customers. We're trying to do our business according to the will of the and according to the laws in each of those states, and to have we thought we knew what the rules were in Oregon. We think we know what the rules still are. We have a little bit of a concern that this definition may open up those rules to change. And so I think that this is something we can work out, but we really need to know, and frankly, other people who are developers need to know, what's the market in Oregon going to look like in the future? Is it going to be a regulated market? Is it going to be a deregulated market? Or if there's uncertainty, then we're going to have a problem with anybody building new resources.
Okay. I interpret everything that you just said. By deleting this language, you're taking us back more towards a regulated market.
There's a possibility of that, and I guess that's what we're
decision. I mean, how does that happen? How would that happen?
Commission.
Okay, so.
Yeah. And so we're working on this with them. I'd say actively and constructively. And I think, you know, we're trying to get to a point where we have a common understanding of how to move forward. It's a pretty important issue to us. We want to be in the business of building new power plants. We need to know the rules that we're building them under.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Craig.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Greg Miller, appearing today as co-chair of the Business Customer Coalition in support of Senate Bill 843 and the -3 amendment. The Business Customer Coalition includes some of our region's largest energy users and employers who are feeling the brunt of higher prices and curtailed operations because of electricity shortages. Business customers strongly support short and long-term solutions to our region's energy crisis, including expedited siting of new generating facilities. We applaud the legislative leaders and this committee for pursuing this legislation. And we also recognize that the legislature cannot make it rain, nor can you fix the California energy mess as much as we would like you to do that. But you can address our region's growing power shortage and afford additional protections to electricity customers in Oregon. Senate Bill 843 and the -3 amendment offer practical and meaningful provisions that will produce additional electricity in our region by this winter, which is our season of greatest need. We urge you to adopt the -3 amendment and expeditious passage of Senate Bill 843. Thank you.
Thanks.
Senator, being a layperson, could you explain those provisions to me that you think are significant?
I got my posse in the back here. They can answer that for me.
In lay terms, if you have to say, this bill does tax, well, what does it do to really accelerate siting?
Well, let's see. Brad, would you like to come up here and help me out?
Somebody out there knows it. I want to be able to explain it to my constituents at some point.
Oh, Gary, got the wrong posse.
Yeah, it's almost anything.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gary Conkling, representing the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities, which is a member of the Business Customer Coalition. The provisions that Mr. Miller spoke in support of include provisions relating to exemption from certificate requirements for both temporary facilities as well as renewable facilities, the expedited review of that as an option for siting of larger facilities, as well as the customer protections that relate to allowing utilities to buy power forward to stand behind standard offers, which is an important customer protection.
Yep. So three things, basically.
Do you have anything else?
Okay. Thank you. That's all we have signed up. Anybody else like to talk to us? Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 843 and open up a short recess.